Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome back to those of you who are back, and you're also welcome if you're just here every week without exception. So, no Bible study today, no. Today or next week.
Okay. So, I saw it next week, but I didn't know about
that. So we may inherit a couple of people who thought they were going to be studying the Bible and will study their neighborhoods instead. We will welcome them, and if they don't want to join us, that's fine. No skin off our back, right?
Yeah.
So
they're lost.
We've been studying Neighborhood Church, transforming your congregation into a powerhouse of mission, and remembering that many of you in our congregation are in places other than this church building every day of the week. So this is sort of looking not just in the immediate neighborhood of our church building, but in the immediate neighborhoods in which you live yourselves as well. We have talked about, we started with talking about communal conversion, the way that that we as a community and then we as individuals have to be converted from sort of an idea that we are sort of living in scarcity to the knowledge of the abundance that surrounds us. And that is one of the ways that we are converted toward God as well. So conversion, not just a one-time deal, but an ongoing process in our lives and relationships. We talked about the DNA of listening. That was, we actually spent a couple of weeks on that because listening turns out to be a challenge for a lot of us, so myself included. So we talked about how do we listen to our neighbors, and we practiced listening to each other. And then you had homework last week. Those of you who weren't here last week, no excuses. I want your homework done anyway. So your homework last week, we had asked you to identify who the connector is in your neighborhood. Who's the person who sort of is the conduit for people to know each other? Who in your neighborhood knows people that you don't know? And then your homework for last week was to actually have your connector over for coffee. And with an ear toward three specific questions. One, what do you love about our neighborhood, our neighborhood, right? Because you and your connector live in the same neighborhood. That's what we're talking about here. So what do you love about our neighborhood? What do you hope for in our neighborhood? And who in our neighborhood do you think I should get to know? So, who in our neighborhood do you think I should get to know? Or if you have a specific someone in your neighborhood that you've already been like, you know, because of where they live or because of sort of what you can sort of gather about who they are and what they're up to in the world that you really want to get to know. Hey, could you introduce me to the people who live at so-and-so, right? So, did anybody do your homework this week?
Well, I asked a dear friend of mine who she thought was the connectors.
Okay.
And she thought that our the members of our, what kind of committee do you call it? Our board. Was the first people that she named.
That's a common place for a connector to be if you've got any kind of neighborhood organization. Which your co-op certainly does, that if there's structure, sort of social structure to your neighborhood, the people in leadership of that are likely to be the connectors, yeah. Did you get to spend any time with any one of those connectors?
No.
Okay.
No. Just the person that I talked to.
Just the person you talked to. And did you get a sense in the conversation with your friend, kind of what their sense of the community was, what they like about being there, what they hope for about the about your little part of the world? Your neighborhood is just shaped differently from a lot of ours. Yeah.
Well, in from talking together in the past, I've known that she's very happy there. Really, there's not all that much that the people who live there would change right now.
Okay. And what do they love about being there? What does she, your particular contact this week, what does she love about being there?
The fact that there isn't, there doesn't seem to be any cliques as such.
Okay.
And everybody is accepted for who they are. You can jump in here anytime now. we've had some problems, but the problems caused us to be closer with each other than dividing us.
Okay.
And we've all said we wouldn't.
We are small enough that pretty you really get to know everybody.
Yeah, so it's a really open, yes, sort of an open network of people. Yeah, so you're not sort of, oh, you know, Dan and Betty, they always hang out with Russ and Mary and not anybody else.
Right, exactly.
Lots of mixing. Okay, great.
Or close proximity, too.
Yeah.
Yes,
that makes a world of difference.
Yeah, and that really does, I mean, that makes the mixing happen more, right? Because if you've got physical proximity to each other and places like settings within that physical proximity that you cross paths, you know, you've got a social room, you've got everybody checks their mail in one place, you've got all these just opportunities to trip over each other. Don't trip over each other, but you've got all these opportunities to run into each other, and that's a good thing. Yeah. Did anybody else talk to a connector in your neighborhood this week? Imagine.
Yeah,
talk. She is the connector.
Well, you know, I'm going to be a little delayed with my conversation because I made a little time to talk with her tomorrow. But she is.
Oh, great.
There are 30 townhomes in our association. They're connected by groups of four or five. So
connected in terms of structurally,
yes,
right? Physically,
yes.
The buildings are
right.
Okay.
And. Just very briefly, if I could, the climate there has been very nasty regarding two huge assessments that were decided by like a 16-14 vote.
Uh-huh.
Big. I mean, when you get into pocketbooks, that's when you get into dissension. So my neighbor has weathered all the divisions and. Mm-hmm. She was willing to run for the board again, and I want to talk with her about how she's sensing the mood. Have people begun to heal, and where is she standing, and does she think that the community of 30 units will pull together?
Okay, yeah. And I picture, if you get to that third question in the conversation, and remember, of course, these are conversations, not interviews, right? So flow through these naturally. But I imagine if you get to that third question about, you know, who in the neighborhood should I get to know, I'm guessing if she's paying attention, she's going to be like, Marilyn is going to be a great resource in helping to keep this community knit together, and she may give you a challenging assignment, and you're going to be up to it.
Maybe I shouldn't go.
So, that's gonna nudge us a little toward today's topic, which is transforming partnerships and identifying partnerships in our neighborhoods, because our neighborhoods are not only just sort of people who happen to mill around together, right? Milling around is a really important piece. Spending enjoyable time together is a really important piece. And sometimes, as neighbors, we find ourselves wanting to actually accomplish something together. You know, that's, again, in a more structured neighborhood such as you have, where, you know, the neighborhood votes on things like assessments for improvements, you know, you are already doing things together, and in a structured way, where in a non-organized neighborhood, right, a neighborhood that's not intentional and structured in that way, the ways that we partner with each other are different. You know, in a non-structured neighborhood, the times that you find yourselves partnering with each other may only be like after a big snowstorm and the people with the snowblowers all partner with each other, and the people without snowblowers just stand at the front window and wave. You know, so there are different ways that neighborhoods may partner with each other or not. Warren?
Point of question here.
Yeah.
Did you not have class last week and do Chapter 3?
We spent a second week on Chapter 2 last week.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Professor, but I was trying to be prepared and read Chapter 4.
Did you also read Chapter 3 along the way?
No, I didn't have enough time.
Fair enough.
I'll catch up on three.
Yep.
Just clarification.
Nope. Thank you. Very good question. Very good question. We did not update the online syllabus, so.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't check that either.
So. I figured you wouldn't have. That's why I didn't update it.
Yeah.
Marilyn.
I'm so glad that John is here today, because I have been thinking for several weeks now about our Faith and Grace Garden, mm-hmm. how that started out. I mean, mm-hmm. they are our neighbors. How mm-hmm. that started out and how it's transformed. I mean, look at it out there. There's a greenhouse, there's sturdy looking bushes, it's enclosed in a fence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just absolute, and it produces, what, how many tons last?
Whoa. Almost 14,000 pounds of produce.
Yeah, mm-hmm. 14,000. And there was initially at Covenant some concern about how it would look, I guess, and overrode by mission-oriented people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's transformed our congregation. There's all kinds of people from the refugee community that come and work there. People here work there. Head Start kids work there. It is just The authors of this book would love our hands-on example.
I think they would, yeah. And I think they would push us on it as well. Because I think they would push us on the question of how dirty are our fingernails.
Right.
Right? So are we, this is actually, the chapter Warren read is right on that point, right? Because next week we'll talk about integrating our space, which means one thing when we're in a church context, right? Because we have space partnerships with other organizations. So we partner with the Faith and Grace Garden. We partner with Toastmasters. We partner with Al-Anon. So there are, you know, there are different, we partner with Head Start in the use of our space extensively, right? And so how integrated is that space use into the life of the congregation? Do we have tenants or do we have partners? So that's going to be next week. And that's going to be a place where I think they would push us on the Faith and Grace Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And would probably push the Faith and Grace Garden as an entity in terms of relationships with both congregations. We're going to talk about partnerships today, and specifically the ways that that those partnerships change us. So this is all sort of under that conversion idea that we are in the places we are, in the relationships that we are, in order to be transformed. in order to be converted to who God is in the world, to the abundance that God has for us, for the big us in the world. And so relationships, obviously, are the key to partnerships, and particularly partnerships that transform us. So tell me about some relationships that you have, just even categories of relationship that you have, that are not based on family. So we have, you know, we have family relationships that, you know, as parents, as children, as siblings, as grandparents, as aunts and uncles and whatever, we've got those relationships that are sort of, if I ask you who are the relationships in your life, that's going to be the bulk of them for most of you. What other relationships, what other kinds of relationship do you have that are not based on family?
My church family.
Your church family. Yeah. Scotia.
Work associates?
I'm sorry?
People you work with?
People you work with, yeah.
Work associates?
Other people at the gym.
Other people at the gym.
They miss us if we're gone.
Yeah. Oh, gym. Gyms are a great kind of neighborhood. Yeah. Who else? What other kinds of relationships do you have?
I've made a lot of friends going to Drake's.
Yeah.
Friends that I see each week. I don't see outside of the games, but that I see each week around.
Yeah, the people right at your neighbors in Section 8, right? Or mm-hmm. Section whatever your section is. I don't know how to... Section O. So yeah, Section O is a neighborhood, yeah. What other kinds of relationships do you have?
Talk about sections that you sit in. We have season tickets to the Broadway series.
Oh, yeah.
And we have some people there. We see regularly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Talk to you.
Yeah. So your network of relationships at the Civic Center.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What other kinds of relationships?
Well, I spent a lot of time as a volunteer driver for the Blood Center.
Yeah.
And it's got two groups. It's the group that are employees of the Blood Center that I see on a regular basis. But then I'm also going out to remote donation sites. You know, VFW halls, church halls, and things. They usually have good snacks. Mm-hmm. it's not related to education. It's a medical thing, and I'm not medical at all, but I'm mm-hmm. around a variety of people. But I am in two retired teacher groups as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so you've got colleagues in these retired teacher groups. You've got contacts in the Blood Center driving network. Yeah. So these are all different relationships that we have that are not about family, right? Now family's wonderful, right? Much of the time. But that's not the only layer of relationship that we have. Just like this congregation is not the only set of neighbors that you have, right? I'm looking around this room, like the person who resides physically closest to where we are right now is Warren, right? John, you don't live closer, do you?
No.
No.
Jerry Castor would probably have the award if he wasn't cruising.
Warren, Jerry's not here today.
Oh.
Yeah. So yeah, Jerry would beat you if he was not on a cruise, but you live physically closest to here. To the best of my knowledge, right? So, but even so, the people you would immediately think of when you think of neighbors are not the neighbors of this church building. So you have two different networks there, even. And so all of these different layers of relationship give us places that we can find also partnerships. This is that place where I transition to the video, and the video always is looking in the sort of the primary context for the book, which is churches in relationship with their immediate neighborhoods of the church building, which is not the same as the neighborhoods of the church, right? Because y'all are the church, and where you are is your neighborhood, is our neighborhood. So we get a really big neighborhood because we live all over the place, and that's great. So they're going to be looking specifically at like institution-to-institution partnerships. And then we get to do some of the translation to think about like family-to-family partnerships, household-to-household partnerships. What could you and your neighbors do together as households in partnership? So I know that takes extra work because you're translating as you listen, but I invite you to think about how we can be transformed in partnership with our neighbors.
Hi, I'm Rob Mueller, co-author of Neighborhood Church, and we're here today to introduce the chapter on transforming partnerships, chapter number 3. You know, any genuine partnership requires of both parties a willingness to engage with the possibility of being transformed and reshaped by that relationship, whether it's a marriage or a relationship between a student and a good mentor teacher, or two organizations that work together side by side, as our congregation has done with the House of Neighborly Service since 1929. I'm seated today in front of a mural that's painted on the wall behind me of the Three Sisters. In indigenous communities, they often planted together three crops simultaneously: corn, beans, and squash, affectionately known as the Three Sisters. These crops work together in a symbiotic way to support one another's development and enable them each to be able to be more fruitful. The corn grows tall because the beans fix nitrogen into the soil that makes them grow more effectively. The corn provides a stalk that the beans can grow up and be supported in their growth and development. And the squash runs along the ground to provide dense cover that helps protect the moisture in the soil for all of the crops. In a similar way, when we work in partnership with neighbors around us, we are able to discover the ability to grow more fruitful and more effective than if we were trying to engage these relationships alone. Our hope for this chapter is that you will discover some ideas and some possibilities for developing partnerships that can help you take your ministry and your mission to a new level as you engage in transforming partnerships together. So we're here in the Jardín de Esperanza, which was built as a small community garden by one of our partners, the San Antonio Time Dollar community. And I'm with Sandra Morales, who is the director of the House of Neighborly Service. And Sandra, when did House of Neighborly Service start?
House of Neighborly Service was started in 1917 by Presbyterian missionaries. Wow. And I think that's where the bond between House of Neighborly Service and Divine Redeemer was created. And here we are today, still working together.
Yeah. We moved in 1929 to the facility that we live in now together. And over the course of that time, the partnership between the church and the House of Neighborly Service has gone through a variety of different moments, some very positive and very mutually supportive, and some very challenging at times. But we're living in a really exciting time right now, and Sandra and I have developed a very tight and close partnership in working together. And we'd like to share some of the things that have been the fruits of that relationship. For example, Sandra, why don't you talk a little bit about what you all do at House of Neighborly Service with young children in Kids Place.
We have an early intervention program that consists of our on-site childcare center, and then we also have a parenting program that's home-based, and then we also have a respite program.
You know, one of the things that I have appreciated about our working relationship is that each of us takes a different piece of the puzzle and helps to develop a program around it so that the families of our community have a continuum of programming that starts prenatal with the parenting programming that you have, and then early education, and then the Peace Pals program, which is the elementary education program the church has picked up and done, into teen years with House of Teens, and then you all pick up and take on some of the major issues that whole families have, like
concern for their food security,
right,
and the ability to provide food, and then especially kind of cap all of that off with your senior program. Say a couple of words about the senior program that you have.
Well, our senior program, we feed our seniors 4 days out of the week. We used to do three, saw a big need for it, so increased it to 4 days. So we provide home-cooked meals, which our seniors love.
And they're delicious.
And they're delicious, yes. And we also provide presentations that meet the needs of our elderly community. So whether it be topics on diabetes, how to cook healthy, and then we provide other activities such as loteria, mm-hmm, which is a favorite.
Yep. Mexican bingo,
right,
if you don't know.
And we also have gone into the home of the seniors. We started that last year. So we're going into the home, assessing their living situation and finding out other ways how we may be able to help them. So we're not only providing their services on site, we're also trying to help off-site with doing those home visits as well.
You know, one thing that this summer is going to happen is, because of the partnership that we have, one of the seniors in your program has a need for their house to be repainted, and we have volunteers coming in from another Presbyterian church to work with Divine Redeemer to help repaint that house for them.
Right.
So that's another example in which your contact with people in the neighborhood gets combined with our connections to other Presbyterians to be able to meet some of the needs that might not otherwise be able to be met. One of my favorite things all year long that we do is the Thanksgiving celebration that we have. We collaborate together with other area Presbyterians and San Antonio Time Dollar, in whose garden we're sitting right now, to do a Thanksgiving dinner for about 400 people in this community.
Right.
And the neighbors show up and they help us set up tables. The Boy Scout troop helps to organize things and put all the tables and chairs in place. The Peace Pals and the seniors do decorations for the tables. Staff from House of Neighborly and members and staff from the Divine Redeemer Church help to prepare the meals. We have volunteers who make donations. We have folks who show up and we do a worship service and we have a fantastic meal. And then it's all over and everybody helps to tear it all down. It's
right.
One of my favorite times.
It's one of my favorites. I've seen that grow from the time I started at H&S up to now, and so just seeing the community come together as a whole is just a beautiful thing to see. And
Sandra, thanks so much. It's so good.
Thanks, Rob.
To talk to you and just feel good about what we are able to do together.
We're so excited.
All right.
Thanks.
Hopefully these stories have inspired you enough to consider engaging in partnerships yourselves in your own community. But be warned, partnerships are dangerous, and they will change you. But that's exactly what a good partnership should do and will do as you extend yourself in mission with your neighbors in your neighborhood.
We saw a lot of different partnerships there.
Yeah, they have all kinds of little partnerships that they bring all together,
uh-huh,
at Thanksgiving with those really cool pine cone turkeys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This looked like an absolutely perfect commercial for our partnership with the Village of San Isidro, mm-hmm, in El Salvador. And I would be remiss if I didn't just mention that.
Right.
And we are looking for people to go.
That's right.
In either the end of May or June.
That's right.
Right now, and we are looking at our 2-year commitment to them as partners. And warning, as he said, you will be changed. You will
guaranteed.
Be.
That's right.
Salvador.
That's right.
So some people sitting here have already been personally invited, and anybody would be a wonderful delegate. And Pastor Nathan has agreed to go again. So, we have a very experienced delegation member.
That's right.
We have a new mission person at OSP, mm-hmm, our sister parish. We've got a great partnership. And you will probably, I have not myself gone, but I'm obviously enthused about the possibilities. So talk to Warren or Nathan.
And
let's go.
So, this is going to sound like Marilyn has not only read the chapter, but also looked at the lesson plan. Because the as we talk about these transforming partnerships and partnerships that are able to actually transform us, right? Because it's possible to do things that look like partnerships but that don't actually change us. But the authors actually turn specifically to international mission as a place where we have learned about how to do partnership. Because we've got a long and ugly history of doing mission in ways that are not partnership, right? That are just sort of bombarding people that we think need our help with the help that we think they need, and that doesn't go well. Typically doesn't go well for them, and it doesn't change us. So they cite five essential missional attitudes that contribute to healthy partnerships, and this is offered to us by Sharon George, who is a former missionary working internationally. Sharon describes these five essential missional attitudes on page 52. She says, the attitude of respect, valuing the otherness of your partner's identity as having equal dignity and worth, expecting there to be differences, but staying committed to understanding rather than judgment. Again, think about what this looks like or what these attitudes can look like in your neighborly relationships. Compassion, the ability to feel the suffering of others, to climb inside their reality long enough to experience it with them, not to fix it, but to feel it. Spend enough time in what may be uncomfortable to you about your neighbor's reality. Not that you can decide what to do about it, but that you can actually experience it with them.
Just being there.
And for crying out loud, be there and don't fix anything. Yeah.
Just be the listener.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Just be
there. Humility. The ability to recognize the limits of our understanding and perspective, opening ourselves to the unique wisdom that comes from our partner's position in life. Your partner, your neighbor, has something to teach you. And you can't, you just can't learn anything without humility. And humility is the willingness to learn and the willingness to understand that you have something to learn, even and especially from someone whose experience doesn't match yours. Observing and participating, learning to balance our doing with being. This is how you have time for compassion, right? We often charge in thinking we know the answers, but listening without doing, that's why we practiced listening last week, listening without answering, right? That silence is a really important quality in a listener.
And this is especially true in ourselves.
Yeah.
Thinking we know what they need.
Yeah. Listening and not thinking we know what they need is especially important in El Salvador. It is especially important when there's a sizable gap between our experience and the experience of the people that we are trying to build a relationship with. It is especially important when there's a power imbalance between ourselves as the listeners and those we are trying to listen to, because those power imbalances are how we find ourselves doing things that turned out not to help. Or found ourselves dismissing somebody's needs and concerns because we knew better than they did. Well, we didn't know their experience better than they do. Receiving and giving. This is difficult to embody with authenticity. Far too much mission work is a one-way transfer of resources and talent from the haves to the have-nots. This one-sided dynamic destroys real relationships. It objectifies both the giver and the receiver into one-dimensional caricatures that impoverish us all. Receiving and giving, which is hard to do. What? I think I almost put that as a rhetorical question. I don't think I'm going to make that a rhetorical question. I think the difficulty of balancing receiving and giving is part of why we don't build relationships with our neighbors. I think the difficulty of balancing receiving and giving is part of why we don't build relationships with our neighbors. Because we don't want to get in their way, right? And we don't want to look needy, right? And we don't want to make them feel like they're a charity case. And we don't want them to get in our way, right? That this reciprocity, I think, is, I think it's what a lot of times we are missing when we look around our neighborhood and say, I don't really know who these people are. We talked a couple of weeks ago about the way that our neighborhood is different these days, and I would venture that most all of our neighborhoods are different these days in the way that we identify. We talked about the sense that, you know, everybody in the neighborhood had, you know, so-and-so has tools and so-and-so knows how to use them and so-and-so has a snowblower and so-and-so has the, you know, the kids who will come trim your hedges in the fall. So we had this sense that everybody in the neighborhood had something to offer. And as our neighborhoods have aged, as our selves have aged, we have found ourselves less and less assuming that our neighbors have something to offer and we have something to offer them. So what do, you know, that's why we did that little asset mapping. What do we have to offer? What do our neighbors have to offer? They're different things than they used to be, but that's why we listen to each other. We listen to each other so that we can actually hear what those gifts to offer are. So I think that giving and receiving is actually, I think that's a piece of what is so hard for us.
Rev, I think,
yes, sir.
Those of us, I know Russ was raised on the farm, as was I, and I don't know, maybe some of the rest of you were. Mm-hmm. I think in the 50s, being a kid on a farm, we were exposed to these just because of the, some farmers were better off than others, some had more equipment, some didn't, and we were helping each other out, whether you were the wealthiest guy in the section or the one that maybe was struggling. And I don't know, you city folk, if you, as I'm growing up now, you know, my first 20 years, where some of this was exposed to me, whether the urban people had that same opportunity that Russ and I had. Just a theory.
That's a good question. People who grew up in town, so this is a town kids versus farm kids question. Town kids, did you have the sense that the people in your neighborhood growing up, so your first 20 years, as Warren said, did you have the sense that the people in your neighborhood had each other's backs, needed each other?
Back then, you could go borrow a cup of sugar from your neighbor if you were baking.
Yes.
Right. You could go borrow a cup of sugar from your neighbor.
There's not as much commonality between neighbors in the city versus the country. Every one of those guys you described were farmers. So they all have tractors and they all have the same basic knowledge level. Whereas my neighbor, I had one side of me was a crack house and the other side was a poor performing attorney. I don't know how you want to phrase it. But then again, down the block, a guy saw that my dad needed a job and he hired him, and he worked for him the rest of his life. Because he had a startup business, and he ended up leaving that neighborhood, but he still kept dad,
Okay.
So I personally, depends on your contacts within the city and what they can offer you. There's more diversity you have to deal with.
Right.
In my mind.
Yeah, and it's a different context because not everybody is doing the same thing.
Right.
In the way that farm families, even if they're growing different crops, they're doing the same doing the same work.
They're talking the same language that says, how's your crop yield this year?
Right.
Planting soybeans versus corn, whereas, you know, I watched, you know, that same house ended up being kind of brothel for a while. It was kind of fun to watch as a kid.
Well, see, back then, you know, you couldn't bale hay alone. You couldn't bring in your crops alone. So by necessity, not a lot of farmers had large families, but not everyone. So by necessity, to get the labor you needed for those critical activities.
Right.
It was just reciprocity.
Yeah, so not that long ago, farming was a really high labor enterprise, and now it's a high capital enterprise.
Because they can't find the labor.
Well, yeah.
Detasseling, baling hay, you can't find
people. Would you pay 10 people to detassel if you've got a thing on your tractor that can do it for you?
Well, that created...
Or you've got hybrid seeds that
don't
have to
be detasseled. That's why they invented the mechanical detasseling. They couldn't get
labor. I'm inclined to see that going the other direction, but that would be a really interesting economics dissertation right there.
I detasseled once, and you couldn't pay me.
Yeah. Couldn't pay you enough to do it again. So did mechanization lower the population on the average farm, or did the lowering population on the average farm prompt mechanization?
Well,
that's a
people leaving the farm.
Yeah, so Scotia.
In urban areas, we've got a reliance upon other persons. They do have similarity. That is obviously raising children and having a house. And so there's some similarities in the rural area with farming. But oftentimes there's a difference. People like oftentimes regular individualism. John Wayne. I was one of those people that was very enthusiastic about rugged individualism, and everybody owned a tractor or a combine or husbandry. But at the same time, there's a specialization in raising children or a house. That one is a plumber, and one is really good at framing, or somebody's very good at plumbing, or fixing windows, or whatever it is. And so there's kind of a symbiotic relationship between persons that are in the urban areas as well as the rural areas. I appreciate the farming aspect. That's really significant. But I think in some ways we have it kind of in the urban areas with regard to children and house.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think maybe you have seen the notes for my sermon this morning. because this idea, as you said, the rugged individualism, the idea that everybody should be able to handle themselves and need no one else. You're right. That's a lie in the city, too, right? It was visibly and relationally a lie back on the farm, right? And still is in a lot of ways, although fewer ways, because farming is more mechanized these days, and so you don't need the team of a dozen or two dozen people to come get your harvest in. You need 20-hour days out in your combine that can do 16 rows at a time. So the dynamics are different, but in the city, you're absolutely right. We have all of these ways that we absolutely depend on one another to get through the day, and the difference is that we don't necessarily depend on each other face to face.
In the rural areas, there was even more so with farming. I'm thinking like the Amish, that are known for barn raising. But at the same time, since obviously people would be roughing, or there was some quarries, people who did various parts of it would be specialized in that rural experience as well. There was more of a reliance upon those things in the rural areas years ago.
Yeah, and I think part of what you have there is when we think about it as a neighborhood, you can think about these farming neighborhoods where everybody directly leans on each other, right? To raise a barn or to get the harvest in or to, the old stereotype of the farmer, driving to town and it takes him 3 hours to get there because he's going like 4 miles an hour checking out everybody's fields on the way. That's what happens. And the ways that neighbors gossip with each other, can be, it has an ugly side, right? But it can be a really beautiful thing because it is a way for neighbors to keep track of what do we need to, what do we need to do? Who do we need to care about?
Yes.
Who needs something that they're not asking for, right? Mm-hmm. Which you can only do in relationship with each other. Many of our day-to-day relationships, as I think Scotia is sort of leading us to, is many of our day-to-day relationships and dependencies on each other are mediated through, are we paying for that, right? So if I pay someone to come fix the plumbing in my house, I don't think of that as a relationship. I may not even think of that as a dependency, right? Well, I most definitely depend on skilled plumbers being available in my community and coming when I need them because I can't plumb to save my life. I can pay someone else to plumb, and I don't necessarily think of that as a relationship, but boy, it is, isn't it? I don't necessarily think of that as a dependency, but it definitely is. Lynn and then Betty.
No, well, my neighborhood... through the junior high in that neighborhood has a website now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm noticing a lot of the neighbors are, saying, anybody used a good plumber? Or anybody need babysitting for such and such a night? And I think that's starting to tie my neighborhood more together. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And every day there's somebody asking for something or something
right.
being offered. On that site.
Yeah, it turns out kids these days want relationships with each other. Betty?
I have a question for the farmers. How much difference in relationship do the farmers have? Because now the farms are big, and your neighbor isn't just a couple of miles maybe down the street from you.
Mm-hmm.
Would that cause a difference in the interaction with each other?
Well, the way things are going now with the destruction and fading, basically, of the farming community, these huge factory farms and the smaller operations that used to be the backbone, the whole thing, are fading out because they can't make it anymore. Mm-hmm. So there is a big difference there. The question you ask about difference in the mechanization and the hiring of people to do things like detasseling and mm-hmm. and I never did any detasseling.
Smart man.
What's that?
Smart man, he says. Yes.
The operations I knew of, they hired kids to do detasseling, but these were mostly kids that were not farm-based.
Mm-hmm.
They needed jobs.
Yeah.
But it's hard work, it's dirty work, and after a while, you can't pay me enough to do that.
Right.
I spent some time walking beans,
mm-hmm.
and that's walking down the row with a what we call a corn knife, machete, basically,
uh-huh.
chopping out weeds.
Right.
Which is not quite as bad as detasseling, but
mm-hmm.
it's no fun either.
Right.
And that's I did that.
And I am not Nathan.
As part of the family. For mm-hmm. farm kid, Dad didn't hire.
Yeah,
hire people to do it, but he didn't enjoy it either.
Right.
So when these herbicides became available,
mm-hmm.
then that eliminated the need to do that anymore.
Right.
But with Dad had the mechanical aptitude. He had the baler and the big combine and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It had. Two brothers with their families, their kids, they used to do harvests together and planting together and things like that. Mm-hmm. Dad would run the machinery, and the rest of the combined families would do the other operations, like combining, for example. Somebody had to drive the truck to receive the grain and haul it to market. Mm-hmm. Baling. Dad and I and my sister did the baling, and the rest of the family put the hay up in the barn. Mm-hmm. It was a very well workable partnership.
Yeah. So you can see in a high labor context how all of those roles and parts and capacities all fit together. Here's an assignment for you this week. Find someone you depend on. Find someone you depend on, especially someone you might not have thought about as, oh, I needed that person, right? Or I benefited from what that person did. You know, it could be the person who makes your coffee at the coffee shop, or it could be the person who picks up your garbage on Monday mornings. It could be somebody who is just kind of invisible in the background of your everyday. And go thank them, specifically telling them the way they made your life better. Go thank them and specifically tell them the way that their work made your life better today. There's your assignment for the week. And if you have not yet had your conversation with your connector but want to do that, please feel free to do that, because we still want to keep rooting in your neighborhoods. But just turning our attention back to those partnerships and the ways that we depend on each other, because we already do. So, attention to that this week. Marcia.
So I came here the first time 3 weeks ago, and I sat here thinking about neighborhoods and thinking, we moved in here about August into, we live in Urbandale, into a house. And our experience versus my mom's experience has been very different. My mom moved into Walnut Ridge, and there's all these people. I know lots of people that live at Walnut Ridge because everybody's real friendly. They're all kind of in the same situation, and people are just real friendly. I had not met a single one of our neighbors 3 weeks ago. I had not met any of them. We'd wave once in a while as we came or went, but
yeah.
Nobody had ever walked over and said anything, and I hadn't walked over to them. And, you know, we're gone through the day, they're gone through the day. Snow has been my friend.
Isn't snow amazing?
Snow, and I'm shoveling, and I finally saw our neighbor next door who on November 11th, which was my birthday, they had done our sidewalk, and I remember going like, oh, that was so nice.
Yeah.
And I went over and thanked him for doing our sidewalk, and visited with him quite a bit, and found out his son lives with him with his kids, and just learned a whole lot about them. They're from Serbia originally, and just this whole conversation, and just real nice people. And then another snowstorm, and the guy across the street came over and said, I can use my snowblower and help you finish up your driveway. And, you know, said, I feel bad we didn't introduce ourselves earlier, told me who his wife and his kids are, and slowly we're figuring out who people are.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of sad that it took as long as it did, but...
But that's a little crack.
And
that's a little crack in the walls between
kids,
us.
Yeah. When I was a kid growing up in West Des Moines, I knew everybody in their neighborhood. I could come home and tell my family who were where and who they were. I knew them all because we all just kind of ran around.
Kids were kids. That was pulling the neighborhood together.
What's that?
When you was a kid.
As a kid, yeah. I knew everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we can talk about kids more, but we do have to go to church. But yes, there's a lot to say about kids and sort of kid density in a neighborhood, which is also different nowadays. Look at the chapter Warren read. Look at chapter 4 next week.
It's a good chapter. It really hits the nail on the head.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.